Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the most entertaining hour of the paranormal in the world, I think. This is Dr. John Stamey, and welcome to ScaryCast. We're so glad to have you tonight. We're going to have a lot of fun. We've got Gabriel Tufano, who I'll be introducing momentarily. He's a friend of my family's, actually, and he's an actor and a producer and filmmaker and all kinds of good stuff. And he's going to tell us about all that. He does some great work, won a bunch of film festival awards and everything, so we're very happy to have him. But first, I will introduce my longest-running co-host, the man that helped get ScaryCast started. Thank God he liked the Addams Family, and he was on a documentary. And he answered his email message. That was great. Devin Tate. Devin, our man in West Hollywood. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really good, John. I'm having a great day, so I'm really happy to be here with you all.
Well, good. Now, what's the COVID situation out there in West Hollywood? We need our COVID update.
Well, you know, I'm still just staying at home most of the time, so I don't know too much about what's going on. I know that LA's numbers are not as bad as other places, so not too bad, but we're still under a mask mandate, so because of that, we're working from home because we have a lot of video conferences, and I don't know if you've ever been on a Zoom call wearing a mask, but it's one of the least fun things you can do, so when we're at home, we don't have to wear masks.
Well, that might be like watching a Conrad Brooks film, but more about that later. Well, we're just glad to have you. And so anyway, the Surgeon General of ScaryCast, a title that has great honor and one of the coolest people that I've ever met, Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, John. It's a good day today.
Well, that's good. Did you do some power washing or what?
Well, today I was doing pest control. I've controlled those pests.
Ah.
So from a career of healing to that of an insect marauder. So I'm an insect marauder today.
Okay. Well, you made sure everything was taken care of, and that's good. Let's see, what was
I
doing
disposed,
today?
And I disposed all of the bodies. So I cleaned up afterwards. No evidence.
Oh, my goodness.
They're just gone. I disappeared the bug.
Our guest will talk about that momentarily, I can guarantee you. Mm-hmm. What was I doing? Let's see. I was out, of course, saving everyone's life, selling life insurance. That's what I like to say. And also working on the new book. The new book, I've got a foot-high stack of references. And it's about paranormal powers that we can all develop. However, I've got a scathing chapter about, what's it about, actually? Come on. I've got a scathing chapter somewhere in here about pseudoscience. And what we're doing is we're not having any pseudoscience in this book. This book is going to contain references to some amazing papers in the IEEE, the Institute for Electronic and Electrical Engineers, to a lot of great research papers to show everybody that this is not just pseudoscience. This is science. This is where my degree from North Carolina State University in the Department of Computer Science says, we're going to show you this is real science. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And dear God, I hope I can get it out for Labor Day. And Devin, I will replace the Lizard Man book with this one for you. And of course, I'll refund your money. You were kind enough to buy the first Lizard Man book that I just decided that I put on hold until the Lizard Man conference. But anyway, so that's what I've been doing and having a blast doing. I spent about, I got $50 worth of copies from Office Depot, so I have copied article after article after article. But it's been fun. It's great to get back to research. You know, Dr. Trey, you enjoy doing what you were trained to do, which is medicine, don't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I love medicine.
We talk a lot about. Well, you're still
don't
a good
really
doctor,
like
I'll
third
tell you
party
that.
Payers, but I like medicine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Well, I still like research. I enjoyed learning the craft, and it's going to be fun making sure that this book is as academically sound as possible, even though it's going to sound like something like develop your psychic powers or some such nonsense. I don't know what it's going to be called, but it's going to be a lot of fun. Now,
what's
to the
easiest,
matter at hand.
What's the easiest psychic power you can develop, John?
It is called Stick, and I'll go ahead and tell you about it. It's the one of the most interesting things. It comes from radionics. Now, radionics is a very weird science. And Trey, do you remember I brought those gigantic bound books on all these settings and everything and all about radionics?
Yes. I remember
well,
that. Uh-huh.
You know, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show the legislation that outlaws radionics on humans in the United States. So that is absolutely enough to guarantee it is not pseudoscience. Absolutely. And Stick is the following. It's the easiest thing in the world. I'm going to ask you to take two cards, get a deck of playing cards, get a face card like the King of Hearts, and get a low-numbered card like the two of Clubs. Turn them over and mix them around, and you don't know which is which. And what you do is you take two fingers, and you go back and forth and back and forth over those two cards, and you'll get to where one of them feels a little bit sticky, and that's probably the one you're looking for, whether your intent was to look for the King of Spades or whether your intent was to look for the Two of Clubs, and that's called Stick, and that is the very first and most elemental step in developing psychic ability. I mean, it was really funny.
When you're going back between the two cards, do you have to have intent that you're looking for one or the other? Or does this all occur when you decide the one I'm sticking to is the two and you flip it over and it is or it is not? But you have intent when you're looking.
Correct. You have the intent. You want to say, I want this card. I want to find the King of Spades. Or I want to find the two of clubs. And you just go back and forth. It's a very natural thing to happen. And it comes, the funniest thing is, it is from, the actual article is called A Fun Short Course in Beginning Radionics by Pennsylvania Pete Ridotti. I mean, nobody's ever seen that book. And it's on the internet, and I printed it out 10 years ago. But it's very interesting how the human mind works. And so I'm going to actually put the legislation that says you can't use radionics on humans in the United States. So that must be enough to say there's something to it or the federal government wouldn't legislate against it. So this book is going to be jam-packed with great resources, great academic, great government resources, and it will prove to you that there are things our mind can do and they have been documented, whether it's by the government, whether it's through major, major research houses or whatever. And I think it's going to be fun. It's going to be something I'm very proud of. I'm proud of my first book, Look Up in the Sky. And some of that's going to be in there. Some of the work with Ingo Swann and Joe McMonagle that I've done. And just I'm going to be very proud of this book. I've learned one thing. Always do something that you're proud of. Never do something that is a sham. Never do something that's dumb. Never hurry something up. Do a great job in what you're doing because it will follow you. It really will. So I'm excited, and we'll talk about it one night on ScaryCast. So I'm just glad to have that, and thank you. That was a great question. So Stick. Nobody knew what Stick was until tonight. So
nope.
Tonight,
and
Gabriel
Tafano. I'm going to try it out. I'll try it out tomorrow. I think that sounds like fun.
That's great. So tonight our guest is Gabriel Tufano. He is an actor. He is a filmmaker. He is a producer. He's a writer, far as I know. And he's a friend of the families, which is kind of cool. He's from the High Point, Greensboro area. Nobody ever talks about Greensboro and High Point down here in Myrtle Beach. We're so glad to have him. Gabriel, how are you doing tonight? So good to have you with us on ScaryCast.
I'm doing well. I appreciate you having me on here. Thank you guys very much. You know, it's really nice, you know, talking or being surrounded by doctors here on like a good note, I guess, because usually it's not good when you're around a bunch of doctors.
Yeah, nobody likes doctors unless you really need them.
Exactly.
Well, we have the most entertaining Surgeon General. We really do. He keeps us in stitches all the time. So anyway, it's great. So now, here we go. Gabriel, tell us just in general about your background, because people that are listening to ScaryCast want to know who in the heck you are, where'd you come from, how'd you get interested in this film business, and kind of what have you been doing for a while? You got all the time in the world. Tell us your story, and then we got some really cool questions to ask you.
Well, that's definitely true. I am a nobody, and probably no one's ever really heard of me. I guess I'll go ahead and say my name is Gabriel Tufano Jr. I'll go ahead and spell that out for people because no one can ever spell my name right. So Gabriel is G-A-B-R-I-E-L, Tufano, T-U-F-A-N-O. You are welcome to check me out and follow me, add me, message me on any social media. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can find me on all those. Always looking for, you know, new people just have a general conversation with. So I'm always open to any kind of conversation. So I'll go ahead and a little bit of background. I'm originally from New Jersey, but I reside in Greensboro, North Carolina, but you can go ahead and say it's the triad. So it's Greensboro, High Point, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I've been doing movie stuff, I would say, for most of my life. You know, it started out as a kid, and I did a few things here and there, whether it was, you know, auditioning or modeling. But I always knew as a kid that, you know, movies is what I wanted to do, but didn't have really an outlet for it. I was always an athlete, so I was basically stuck in sports for the majority of my, you know, young life. And I always thought, you know, how do you make it into the movie business? So I thought maybe I'd just become a professional athlete, and then that would give me the foot in the door to become part of the movie industry. I would say professionally, I've been doing it for over a decade and a half. I started out, it's weird because, you know, times have changed from when I first started. You know, I started from the bottom, and I've worked my way up, but everything's different. Started out like your average person couldn't purchase like a camera, so you know, you had like camcorders or your dad, like home video stuff, almost digital videos and whatnot. Now everything's completely digital. No one can purchase a camera at the time because film and film stock is so expensive. I started out during that kind of era, and then, you know, gradually worked my way up. At the same time, everything kind of evolved, and now you can literally shoot a movie on your phone now. It's been a interesting transition throughout the years, but you know, seeing, you know, new film people, whether they're actors, directors, editors, and everything, and they never got to experience things that I experienced. And obviously, I couldn't imagine, you know, people in the 80s or the 90s how they had to go about things, because there's literally nothing, and there's like, the internet wasn't there. and stuff. So I'm pretty much self-taught. I've taken various film classes, lessons, tons of meetings, been part of film groups and whatnot. But probably officially my first acting gig was probably, it's well over a decade and a half ago. I can't even pinpoint which was the first exact one. But I've been involved with, hundreds of projects, whether, I worked at bottom of the totem pole or to, the top.
Right, because I've seen, when you go on the internet, and I look for your name, and I've seen you in a variety of positions and things, from all the way at the top, from being the producer and being the star to being the bottom. So you have, and I'm going to say this about our educational system and you. I know that you can go get a bachelor's degree in film from somewhere, like UNC Greensboro or wherever.
Correct.
But that is not how you learn to make films. You learn to make films by two things, being good at it and learning from the best. And learning, just learning. It's I think it's one of those skills that you can't go get a degree in and be guaranteed that you can do anything. I don't know if you go to some of the film schools in New York or you go to Full Scale, you probably have a leg up on a lot of people. But I think you may have picked up on the right way to learn how to make film. I mean, it's the school, you have graduated with a degree in film from the School of Hard Knocks, right?
That would be a very good way of wording that, yes. I'm not going to discourage people from film school or acting school, but I'll say probably from a film school standpoint, again, I'm not going to discourage it or whatnot. I'll just say you don't need that. I would have said that 10 years ago. It was something that was always said, I was told, now I preach that as well. I started out pretty young. So at the time it would have been, I'm doing everything that's making a movie or being in the movie. I'm doing all that. But then to stop that, to then go to film school or acting school and then pay a bunch of money to then throw you back into the world that you're already in, I basically made that decision not to do that. And I think it was the greatest decision that I've made, or one of the better decisions I've made with film, for sure. I don't discourage people from going to film school, but I like to consider, and I know I'm probably getting a bunch of hate for this, is, universities and stuff, what they teach is they're teaching the same stuff to the same people, and they're teaching just repetitive stuff to then basically throw out a bunch of robots into the world. Now, I'm not saying when you're going to get, if you're on one, film department, whether you're an editor or something like that, having that degree in it, you'll most likely get hired for some kind of editing gig, for example. But if you have a resume and a body of work that you can show somebody that's good, I don't see why they would turn it down. And that's just those are my thoughts. Those aren't other people's thoughts. Those are just strictly my thoughts on everything in that aspect. And I could go on for hours about this stuff.
I tell you what, Gabriel, I want to clarify what I'm talking about here, because I have a degree in music, an undergraduate degree in music. And we're talking about the field of arts. We are not talking like Dr. Trey Donaway, to be the master surgeon that he became. he had to go to Duke University. He had to go to the University of Pennsylvania. He had to do residencies all over. I mean, to build his craft and to do it, that is, the science field is different than the artistic field that we're talking about. I mean, frankly, I was crushed when I had just graduated from Wake Forest University, and I found out my uncle, who was a dentist, he said, "I didn't know you were so interested in music." Now, they lived in Winston-Salem. I graduated from Wake Forest University. I said, "Oh, my God, yes, I took percussion from Massey Johnson, who was the dean of the North Carolina School of the Arts. I struggled for 2 years to learn how to play snare drum from Massey Johnson, who was famous all over the world." He said, "Well, if I'd known you were really that interested, you could have become a student of Hans Heidemann, who was one of the great pianists. He played at Carnegie Hall. He played it everywhere. My parents would never have had to have spent the thousands upon thousands of dollars if I could have studied with Hans Heidemann. He would have put me in the network and everything." And I mean, I don't know how that disconnect happened. So we're talking about the arts. And it's like, you know, Andy Warhol's gotten a lot of bad press, and maybe for good reason. But I'll tell you what, if you hung around Andy Warhol, you became somebody in the art business, and you became John Schneider of, the Dukes of Hazzard. I mean, that is how the art business works. The art business is not a collection of doctoral degrees or master's degrees. The art business is what you learn how to do, and I think it's the apprentice program, which is what I think you said, and that's why if you're in science, get a PhD from NC State like I did, or get an MD degree like Dr. Donaway did from University of Pennsylvania. But if you're an artist or a writer, you should have studied a long time ago with William Faulkner. You should have studied with William Faulkner, or you should have studied with Truman Capote. And if you wanted to be a filmmaker, go study with the filmmakers and learn your craft. So there's my rant for this evening, but I hope you agree with me that art, which the filmmaking process is something that you experience, and you can't learn from a book. And you said, if you want to be an editor, you know, go there. You can learn how to use editing software, and that's fine. But I'm guessing that you will agree that the art and craft of making a film comes from working with the best and experiencing it. Do you agree with me? Now, you can yell at me and say, "John, you're wrong," or you can say, "John, maybe you're right." What do you think?
I agree with you. I would like, if I'm going to see a doctor, I would hope that they're qualified and went through proper training and everything. But film in general, art and whatnot, you can't get better than hands-on experience. Just observing, and I think a lot of it is you really like whatever you love. So I don't even think you have to be a filmmaker or a quote unquote filmmaker or film person to make a movie. If you have like love and passion for something, I think you can go do it. Obviously there's, you know, if you have a high IQ, you can easily do it. Not easily, but you know, you can have a better shot at doing that kind of stuff. But hands-on experience, is always, I believe, the best. And I think it's nice to be able, you know, if you when you're starting out, start out at the bottom and observe and be on as many film sets as you can and see how people work. Now, I will say, like, if you're going to go to school or pay for lessons or private tutoring, I guess you can say, from people, like, if you can learn from the best, then I would say go for it. You know, famous directors, actors, if you can talk with them one-on-one, or there's the master class stuff from that they put out, you pay for it, that you learn from some of the best people that have been in the film business, and they're great learning things and can learn a lot. But I will say love and passion, to me, is the first thing. And I will also say that there has to be some kind of like raw talent, or it's just something that you have. And it's so hard to describe, what makes a good actor and what should you do to make yourself be better, or tell somebody, this is, what I think you should do and whatnot. First of all, I think you just need to have it. And it's just something you have to come in your own mind to a conclusion of, basically like crafting it in some way. You have to be creative, especially to stand out from people.
And thank you very much. And I'm glad you agreed with me, frankly. Made me feel good, because I am an artist, among other things. Well, I'm going to open up the floor. Dr. Trey Donaway, and then Devin, and then I'll ask you a question. We'll keep going around the room. But Dr. Trey, what would you like to ask Gabriel?
Gabriel, what type of films have you done? What genre, or has it been a variety? What are your film topics?
Every genre I've been a part of.
Right.
I can't even tell you like I've done more of this one than that one, but I mean you're just generic. I mean, drama, romance, fantasy, sci-fi, horror, a mystery, thriller, action. I've been a part of every genre out there, subgenre of film.
Since this is Scary Cast, tell us a little bit
about horror films, how you
got into horror films, what your inspirations were, and what are the elements that make a horror film pop?
Okay, that's good. Horror films as a kid was probably my biggest influence into getting into movies. The funny thing is, as a kid, I was actually super scared of, horror films, or even things that weren't even scary, I was actually pretty scared of. Somehow, I guess, grow up a little bit and not be super scared anymore. There's definitely a when you're making a horror film, it's not scary when you're making it. It's a the finished product could be scary. I started out very young, and horror films are a big thing. The original Halloween from 1978, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho from 1960, were big films. So John Carpenter did, stuff 70s, 80s, 90s, Wes Craven, 70s, 80s, 90s. So, very classics. Halloween, The Hills Have Eyes, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Even the 90s, Scream is one of my all-time favorite films, along with the Scream franchise. I could go on and on about, some of the films that really got me into getting into the movie business. I will say that the Saw franchise, especially the original Saw film from 2004, and Hostel.
That was terrifying. Sorry.
Yeah, from 2005, were big big influences on me. There's also some of Rob Zombie's earlier films, horror films that he did, were a big part of me getting into film. I could go into I was into teen comedy films as well, but I won't, because it's a horror podcast. I won't get into that. Yeah, I mean, just the cult classic, again, they just don't make them like they used to, I feel like, anymore. So there's just kind of very nostalgic. And definitely during the time I got to experience almost like a wave of different horror films, because there was a time in like the 90s and early 2000s where horror was kind of quote unquote dead. And then that's when kind of the more graphic, I would say, horror films started coming out in like the earlier to mid 2000s.
You know, I think there's an element of teen comedy in a lot of horror films I've seen. It always seems that the lines is pretty much one or the other, or sometimes both. First one, well, we better get some rest. That seems to be a common line I hear in teen horror films. And the other one, of course, is we ought to split up. Which again,
it's never
a good idea. It's just never a good idea. You don't need to get some rest if something's after you. And splitting your forces doesn't just seem to make it. But teens seem to make those choices a lot. Is that in your experience of horror film producing with teenagers?
Absolutely. There's definitely, I would say, obviously, it's, a lot of them are like the subgenre of horror, the slasher films, where, you know, it does most of the time revolve around like teens, you know, doing and saying stupid things. It is interesting because, you know, horror as a genre actually does incorporate comedy in it, because, you know, at times I feel like, you know, to make a good horror film, there does need to be some comedy elements possibly sprinkled throughout. So you can kind of, like, it's not like the audience is, like, straight from the start in a horror world. Having some kind of comedic relief is definitely something good. So you can kind of, like, you know, you can do it, you know, you can get some scary stuff in there, but then you kind of bring it down some with some comedy stuff, and then you then can turn up the notch from that. Now, I don't know with a lot of the very low-budget, cheesy, corny slasher films, or, like, there was the wave of them in the 80s. I don't know what their intentions were with it. If it's purposely bad writing and purposely bad acting, I can't speak on all that. I know some of it was. It is kind of funny, you know, you can just sit there when you're in the theater watching it at home, you're just yelling at the TV about the stupid things that most of the time kids or young adults, you know, doing probably the exact opposite that they should be doing, if they're in a horror film or if something horrific is going on.
Well, I know in my profession, we had a bunch of doctors that would go out to the movies every once in a while. We have a very nice little theater, actually, that's its name, the Little Theater in Camden, South Carolina. It's named Little, not because it's small, but because Mr. Little was the manager of the theater, I think, in the 40s. And so the Little Theater is still here. But before we'd go to the Little Theater to watch the most recent horror release, we would all take a pool and guess how many teenagers were going to be killed in the horror film. And that was always fun to see who would win the bet. And then would give us something to do during the film to keep track of the score of how many teenagers got killed before the end of the movie.
Absolutely, and then probably most of the time you just want them all to die because they're just all just not playing with a full deck, I guess.
Yes.
And you look
and
at it,
you know,
oh
it's sometimes hard to really write and create, you know, very likable characters, but it seems to be a lot of times that they want, and I don't know if this is, again, what their intentions are, is for people to kind of enjoy the killer more than the people, the good the good guys making the stupid choices. So it's almost like they're getting what they deserve. And then, you know, most of, there's some kind of backstory between characters, and they purposely make some of the characters super unlikable, so you definitely want to see them die. To me, you know,
well, even
it's
when
just,
you look
it's
at
just
Freddy,
more
Freddy,
entertaining.
Freddy, Freddy with Nightmare on Elm Street, he always has some great one-liners in
oh, absolutely.
The movies.
The writing for that it was actually very, very well done. People don't understand the original Nightmare on Elm Street is like is very horror-esque with minimal comedy from Freddy Krueger, and then after that, after the sequels and the billion other Nightmare on Elm Street films after that, that's when they kind of turned Freddy Krueger into this kind of joking villain. But the original one,
yes, indeed.
Right. In the original one, he's not in it for that much, and there's some very scary moments in it. Yes, he does have his, a few things here and there where he says, you know, kind of funny things in the way he goes about it. But the original one again is to me, I mean, it's a classic. It's very well done, and yeah, Freddy Krueger, who everybody knows, was not the wisecracking villain that, you know, he is these days. Again, he's got his costuming is very gruesome, and was definitely very gruesome from the start, from the first film, and then going on, they definitely did that work. I mean, just the whole fact that he's like burned to death, and you're basically seeing, you know, muscle and tissue and stuff. But it's kind of cool, you know, he wears a hat and whatnot. So I always thought somebody that wears a hat looks cool. So some kind of like fedora.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now this isn't necessarily horror related, but it is comedy related. And what I often find interesting in a comedy film is when the actors they do something spontaneous, or it seems spontaneous. I don't know if it's a rehearsed spontaneity or it actually is just they're riffing and they can come up with some of the funniest stuff in the world. Because obviously, if you're a comedic actor, hopefully you have a sense of humor, and it just spills out of them. What's your experience with that when you're doing a comedy? How long do you let the actors riff and just kind of play with lines that's unscripted, not rehearsed, but when there's chemistry between the actors on film, and that translates out to just a very good bit to put in a film? How does that work? Do you encourage that as a director? Do you ask for it? How does that all come together?
I'll say, coming from an actor and coming from a director's point of view, I'll say for a director, don't say cut until give like some space where to kind of just let, because an actor is there to do their thing. Don't yell cut too early. Also for actors, don't just stop unless the director says cut. It's improv, so is what you're talking about. There's very happy accidents, and it just depends. I mean, experience as an actor of just instinct kicks in. And acting is you know, just kind of feeding off each other rather than just remembering lines. So if I'm going to teach acting to somebody, I'm going to say, I'm not worried about somebody remembering lines. I want somebody to be able to react from another person or be able to react in a, it just depends, in a natural way for a lot of stuff. Now there's obviously other ways to go about it where you want them to be over the top or something like that. And whatnot. But, improv is definitely, it's just an instinct thing that kicks in, whether you're an actor or director. I mean, for a director, I feel like yelling cut is, too early is not good. So it's just let everything play out. If it's not exactly what was on the script or whatever, just let them keep going. There's no reason why you shouldn't let them, the actors, to keep going if they've got something going, like, that seems good. And again, a lot of things are happy accidents. It actually happens on most sets. And also story can change and characters can change throughout filming. So it's kind of just letting everything go and just letting it and just go with it, basically. I hope
that's
I
why you have
question.
Good editors. Gabriel, you've got great editors to make it look like it was rehearsed and perfect when it could have been just spontaneous improvisation.
Editors are a huge key and can make a bad actor look good. So I always push for if I'm working on a project, you know, I kind of want to know who the editor is, so then I know. You know what, if I don't give a good performance, you know, this person can probably make me look a little bit better.
Right.
You know, Gabriel, this is so funny, because two of the greatest comedies of all time were the result of the director not saying cut. The first one was 1928, The Coconuts, starring Groucho Marx, which is still the largest grossing film adjusted for inflation in history. And Groucho made so much money.
I don't know how you can direct them. It's the same, like the Marx Brothers, the Jim Carrey. It's just kind of like you just let them do their stuff. Like, just keep the camera rolling.
Right.
And sometimes the best directing is no direction at all.
Probably sometimes
right.
The best direction
the other one,
when they turn to the cameraman and say, did you get that? Did you get that?
Yeah. As long as they're recording.
Exactly.
Yeah, make sure you're recording.
And then I have to say, because we have to give props to the greatest comedian since 1975, which is Rodney Dangerfield, and his performance in Caddyshack was beyond compare.
Absolutely.
And just one of the funniest things in history, and they just let the camera roll. It was genius. And I've always wanted to say this in a meaningful situation, and I think we have a meaningful situation here because we've got an experienced guy. And Dr. Trey Dunaway's question, and Dr. Trey, I hope you didn't mind me adding this, because I'll tell you what, the Rodney Dangerfield performance in Caddyshack and the Groucho Marx performance in Coconuts will go down in history as the two greatest comedy performances. And it's just like, let's just do this. I'm sorry. I'll shut up. Okay. Anyway, Dr. Trey, did we get your questions answered?
Oh, yeah. That was good. Thank you.
I mean, I'll
great.
I can
okay.
elaborate
okay.
more.
Okay.
I'll also say Peter Sellers, a great comedic actor, where it's, I don't know how the director would go about trying to direct him. But you just kind of like let him do his thing.
Especially when
and
Kato
he
being
comes
there.
Into the picture.
Oh, right. Some of the Pink Panther stuff. And yeah, but you know, he did a great performance, like Dr. Strangelove. And you know, you don't really get.
Oh my
and,
God.
You know, Kirk Douglas did it, you know, sometimes. And there's some actors out there. It's not, it used to be done more often where they're playing multiple characters throughout the film. And it's, you know, to be able to switch from one character to another. I mean, Peter Sellers, I mean, he's done like five characters in one film, and it's just crazy to me the way that, you know, he could do that. Because in when I do, it's like I prepare for a character, so I do put as much because I just love films and movies in general. I don't do films. Or make films for myself. I make them for other people. But I do put my heart and soul into the films that I do or that I act in and whatnot. So, you know, hats off to, I mean, the greats for being able to wear many hats, basically, and do many different things. It can be very tiresome. You know, staying up all night trying to figure out how you know certain lines need to be said, And then you're just sitting there, you're looking in the mirror for hours, and you're trying to recite it. Well, I don't like that. I don't like how I look. And then finally, I mean, I would like to say, like, there's this certain routine that I do. I really don't. It's many different routines throughout, you know. It just depends what project it is and what character I'm playing is the way that I go about the things. And then obviously memorizing lines has been another key thing. But, I mean, if you repeat something over and over again, finally it's going to stick in your head. And then even though you remember your lines, and that's the thing with a lot of actors, I don't know if I'm getting sidetracked here, off track, is actors, I'll say more trained actors, the one thing that they can do is remember lines. The thing is, but if you can't say those lines properly in or in a normal way, then it's not a good performance. So again, that's why I don't preach remember your lines. That's the thing. It's like, that's just a part of being an actor. It's how can you remember the lines, know how to say the lines, but at the same time react. Like, you got to be in the moment with the other person you're acting alongside, or multiple people, or no people at all. You literally have to just kind of zone out, and you're a different person. You're in a different world. Your personal life doesn't exist anymore. And that's where people, I've seen, you know, many people, where as soon as the camera is rolling, because people don't understand that there's not just the cameras rolling, but there's people way behind. There's all people all around you, and people just freak. I mean, it's like public speaking. I mean, I hate public speaking, but if you're able to just turn that thing off in your head where you're just kind of in a zone, then you shouldn't have a problem, and you should give a good speech. You should give a good performance. But for some reason, if all eyes are on you and a camera's there, some people just freak. Yeah, I mean, there's been times where I've kind of caught myself, you know, overthinking, or, you know, being self-conscious and whatnot. But you just, over time, you just have to say, screw it. Like, it doesn't matter what people are, like, what people are looking at you or whatever you're saying. Like, just be in the zone and do what you need to do. And then you will enjoy the product that eventually comes out once everything's all said and done.
Well, Gabriel, that is true. And there's a big difference between public speaking and acting, but there's some convergences. I was a member of the National Speakers Association. I did professional speaking for a little over a decade. And, you know, when I'd go to National Speakers Association meetings, I remember early on meeting a guy who was an actor who became a professional speaker. And his methodology of speaking was, well, you memorize your script, and then you do your blocking, and then you put it all together and you put on a performance. And I said to myself, if I have to do that, I'm not going to do professional speaking. Rather, if you know your material backwards and forwards and you carry on a conversation, although it's mainly me doing the conversation, that just worked better, because then all I had to do is remember what topic I was supposed to talk on, and I had ways to just keep me tracking, and that worked a lot better. But if I had to memorize everything and block and perform, I gave performances, but not in a theatrical way. It would be very difficult. But again, it just depends on how you react to it.
Correct. It's all about preparation. And if you don't take it seriously, and again, there's a public speaking or anything. If you don't take it seriously and you think you can just walk up there and do it, you're probably not going to be able to do it.
All you have to do then is look at the introducer who decides to go off script for the introduction, and then you just watch him dig a hole. Unfortunately, he's putting you in the hole, and you got to climb out of the hole in order to get up to level ground again. So it is an interesting art. craft, interesting craft.
It's definitely a craft.
That's right. It's an art form. Well, Dr. Trey, thank you for those wonderful questions. Now, I've got to say that we have with us, and we'll get to him after Devin Tate, we have Professor Wrestling Steve Logan. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good. May I ask some questions?
Well, let's let Devin go, and then we'll let you go, and thank you for being with us. Devin Tate. You are the master of horror films, so ask away. Ask away. I can't wait to hear your questions.
Yeah, I don't know. Hopefully, I'll get around to a question. I was just having a lot of thoughts of what was been discussed so far, and you know, I love movies. I love horror movies, and I think the reason that I started loving them was, you know, I was a kid in the 80s, and at home, my parents wouldn't let us watch scary movies. You know, we weren't allowed to watch any horror. We weren't even allowed to watch the Michael Jackson Thriller video. So I had to watch that and any other horror movie I could at my cousin's house or at a friend's house. So it's kind of always like that forbidden, you know, the allure of the forbidden. But I always loved the horror movies. And I think in the 80s, you know, I think I tended to see like a lot of the sequels. A lot of the films had been made into franchises by then, like Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween and Friday the 13th. And yeah, I think you kind of hit on it. Like they, you know, when you make a horror movie the first time when it's a standalone movie, obviously the killer is kind of like the bad guy that you're supposed to be scared of. But then to turn that into a franchise and make a bunch of sequels, you have to then suddenly make the killer the interesting person, right? That he's the person that's going to bring people back to the theater again and again. And so I think that's when they bring in more comedy, more quirky stuff. You know, and as a result, sometimes those sequels really aren't all that great when you look back on a lot of them now. Some of them are very incredible.
100%. It's all about marketing and money. And why if you can make money off of something, why put more money into writing or writing better stuff? So, you know, that's when they just kind of started going down a path where they can basically not put 100% into, because, like, you know, again, the originals are the originals, the first one, standalone, there was time and effort and whatnot put into those, and then it kind of, you know, takes another turn where it's like now it sells itself, when at first they're trying to sell that product and get people in the theater. And then they already have some, like, whether it's the killer or whatnot, or the monster, that figure now is basically the selling point. So then they don't have to put money into the resources that they originally put it into.
Right.
But I'm the same way with you. My parents wouldn't let me watch horror films or, you know, anything of the sort. So it was like, you know, going to friends' houses, or, you know, when your parents went to bed at night and you'd put on a scary movie or something, or same thing at my, you know, your friend's house having a sleepover, was the time to watch that stuff. I'm not saying I don't disagree with my parents, with doing that. If you're a certain age, I do think there should be a limit on what people should be allowed to watch. Though, again, you can't stop people or kids from doing things all day, every day. Like, you know, they're obviously, even if you're younger, there still is some freedom, whether you're spending the night at a friend's house and whatnot. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an age, and it's obviously not the same age for everybody, but there's, you know, there's definitely an age where you're too young to really maybe even grasp the concept of a movie, that it's just pretend, it's make-believe, that didn't really happen, so it would scare you. But then at some point, I think, especially for me, when I finally did start watching horror films, it had the opposite effect of, like, it didn't make me more scared, it made me less scared, because not only did they put the comedy into it, but also you're put into these situations in a movie where you can kind of allow yourself to feel scared, but then in real life you think, okay, well, that's that's something out of a movie. That probably wouldn't happen in real life. If it does happen in real life, it's like a one in a million type thing. So I don't need to be afraid that I'm going to open my closet door at home and there's going to be a murderer in there. Like, that just statistically is probably not going to happen.
No, yeah, you never know, Devin. You never know.
you never know. There's chances of.
We better get some rest. Why don't we split up?
Yeah, right. Split up and look for clues. But yeah, no. That, I mean, that's why people go to theaters. It's almost like a way of like giving yourself relief, or like, you know, going to a therapist or something where you can kind of live out something or that is not real. It could scare you in the theaters, and it might have some lasting effects on you for a night or two or whatever. But really, you're like in a comfortable environment because it's a movie.
Totally, yeah. And then when you get scared a few times in a movie, it's not so bad when you really have a scare in real life, because you've already kind of had that adrenaline rush. You can recognize it and you can maybe deal with it a little bit better than if you had never had that experience.
Wow. That's great. All right. Stephen Logan, Professor Wrestling, you're here with us. Have you got a question for Gabriel?
Yeah. Any interest in voice acting? Animated movies and video games are pretty iconic. And the Silent Hill purists are very, divided on the voice acting and the remakes and Silent Hill games.
What's your question? Do I like any of those?
Any experience or interest in voice acting?
Oh, absolutely. I have not done any like animation voice acting, but I mean, I've done, narration, voiceover. I have voiced over other people's dialogue on a handful of occasions. When that happens, it's a huge process trying to match your words with the way that their mouth is moving. I do have a kind of a distinct voice, so I have gotten work in that aspect. I find it's very interesting and it's different. But it's something I would love to do more often, for sure. But you mentioned Silent Hill. I actually loved the 2006 film Silent Hill. I thought that was a pretty scary film. I know that's voice acting. I would love to I'd love to do voice acting for a video game or, you know, a cartoon or something like that, for sure.
Yeah,
well,
Mark
great.
Hamill got plenty of work as Joker for those animated movies and video games. But also, I wanted to ask, are you a fan of the A24 Studios films?
I'm going to say this before I answer that question. I am a huge fan of Mark Hamill in the Batman animated series Joker. I'm actually a huge fan of Batman animated series in general back in the 90s because I'm a big fan of film noir, and it was the Batman animated series was they did it in like a film noir universe. Loved the Joker in that. The Joker is definitely one of my favorite characters of all time. A24. I'm a big fan of A24's films that they put out. I think they mainly buy films rather than make them and produce them themselves. I think they're the ones that go to festivals and whatnot and actually buy a lot. I believe that they actually do their own productions, but the films that they put out or they quote-unquote produce, and whether that they produced it themselves or most likely they picked up from a festival and whatnot, I'm a huge fan of I just recently watched from them St. Maud, beautifully shot film, acting's on point. A24 is definitely a heavy hitter in the film industry these days. I do enjoy their films. They really know what they're doing in the sense of if they're acquiring the rights to a film and whatnot. They know what they're like with the. They know the. It's a really good director. The cinematography's great. The story's really good, and they're all very effective. Whether you know, some people could say some of the films are a little bit boring or have some boring parts throughout. I'm not going to say I can disagree with people, but I am a big fan of the A24 films.
Oh yeah, I love Midsummer, The Lighthouse, The Witch. Like, so just such good stuff, and I want to watch the Green Knight when I can get a chance. But one last question before I let you go: is there any chance of you doing like international films or? I don't know if you can speak another language, but there's some really interesting Japanese horror that I've gotten into in years past, like Ringu and Grudge and Audition. Any interest in the international films or international horror?
Yes, 100% there. I'm actually a big fan of Audition. I believe that came out in 1999. I do like foreign horror films. One that I watched, and this was during the Saw and Hostel, I guess what they call it now, torture porn horror subgenre. It was called The Frontiers. It was like a French version of like Saw meets Hostel.
Right.
I'm not afraid to watch a film that has subtitles. I don't know how to speak Japanese, but if you can write it on a piece of paper and you got an acting coach, I'll do it as an actor. So I'm 100% all I would definitely do an international film. I have not been a part of an international film. I've been a part of films where there is other languages spoken for short, like, you know, not the whole film, but, you know, at bits and pieces of the film.
You know, it's real funny.
Thank you so much.
About,
and,
well,
yeah, Dr. John, please.
I want to make a comment about what you just said. Well, if you can write it on a piece of paper and put it on as a subtitle, it's okay. I think one of the greatest films ever made was The Ice Storm. Are you familiar with that oldie but goodie? Nominated for every Academy Award, didn't win any of them. Or it won one or two of them. But The Ice Storm was a Japanese film about New York City, or about a little burb outside of New York. And you know the fact is, if you want to make a big hit film, just do it in English. But are you familiar with The Ice Storm? Is anybody on our panel tonight familiar with The Ice Storm?
I am not familiar with that film, no.
All I got to say is if you don't know it, you need to watch it. It's one of the greatest films in history. It was a shocker. It was an absolute shocker. It is the first non-horror film ever. And somebody died at the end, but it was a great film. So that's what I'll say. Well, what I'd like to do, and I've got a quick question for you, then I want to circle back around to Dr. Trey and to Devin, and then we're going to say sayonara because we have, I think, what do we have left? We have 25 minutes, and that'll be about perfect. But I want to take just like 2 or 3 minutes. When I was an undergraduate at Wake Forest University, I wrote my senior thesis was Horror in the Supernatural, which is the name of a book written by H.P. Lovecraft. And Gabriel, I'm sure you're a little bit familiar with H.P. Lovecraft, correct?
Absolutely. One of my favorite horror films is In the Mouth of Madness by John Carpenter, who did Halloween. Is a H.P. Lovecraft-inspired film. And it's if you guys have not seen that film or have ever heard of it, it stars Sam Neill from Jurassic Park. It's got Charlton Heston in it. It's a very good, very well done horror film, and it's inspired by Lovecraft. I'll say it's the best Lovecraft film I've ever seen. It's really good. It's very creative, and I would highly suggest in watching that film.
All right, here's my comment. H.P. Lovecraft summed everything about horror in one sentence. He said, "The most frightening thing is what you can't see." Now, we're all about gore, blood, and guts and everything. Do you agree with H.P. Lovecraft? Because he knew what he was doing, and he said it in one sentence. The most frightening thing is what you can't see. Does that really apply to film?
I would say yes. I'm not saying for every film, but I would say for a lot of the films, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, nightmares.
It's also the unknown, like, you know, it's whatever you can't see or it's the unknown kind of a deal. And I know Lovecraft deals with the unknown. And, you know, his work revolved around kind of that stuff. And, you know, it's interesting to see, like, all the Lovecraft illustrations because Lovecraft never drew any of the what he described in his writings. But just seeing the illustrations are pretty crazy.
Out of space. Yeah.
Correct.
Yes, Trey, what did you have to say?
You know, our nightmares, you can't see our nightmares, but those are the scariest things that we encounter routinely. So, yes, it's what you can't see. It's what your imagination brings forward. Because often what you imagine
is
the actual experience.
Oh, yeah. People always used to say, like, oh, don't watch a horror movie before bedtime because you'll have nightmares. And I was like, well, I want to have nightmares because then it's like I'm the star of the horror movie, you know. I actually like that feeling.
That's right.
And I like that feeling when you wake up and you're so scared, but then, like, in a second you realize you're safe in your own bed and everything was just a dream, you know.
That's right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
I'm glad
H.P.
Lovecraft
way.
Is still relevant.
Oh, he'll be relevant till the end of time, for sure.
But it's a very effective way of if
people can make up what they want in their own minds. It's, you know, going back to Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. In the shower, the famous shower scene, there's never when Norman Bates, Anthony Perkins is stabbing in the shower, there's actually no ever contact with the knife and the Janet Leigh. There's no knife contact, but you think it's going in it. So that also kind of like plays in that as well. It's the same thing in Saw. When Carrie Elwes is cutting off his foot, you actually never see him cut off his foot. You just think you really think you're watching him cut off his foot, but they never show it. They show the aftermath of it, but they really don't show much. So again, leaving it all to your imagination is probably the best way to go to be effective.
Right. There was, and I'll go ahead and admit it, one of the most frightening porn films of all time was Ilsa of the SS, and they were always torturing Americans, cutting off parts of their body and everything, and you never could see it, and it was the most frightening film. They said it was a porn film, but it never really was. It was absolutely, though, one of the most frightening films I ever saw. I saw it as an undergraduate at Wake Forest in some sleazy little place, and it still to this day is one of the most frightening films I've ever seen, because you don't see any of that, but you hear lots of screams. So, you know, they did their job. They did a great job. So anyway, all right. So We're going to go to Dr. Trey and then Devin, and then I will bid everybody adieu. So, Dr. Trey, do you have one more question for Gabriel?
No, Gabriel, but it's been an enjoyable evening talking about your experience as an actor, director, filmmaker, and we're glad we got to know you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's definitely been a pleasure.
Well, great. Well, thank you. And, Devin, do you have anything else you'd like to ask our guest?
I went ahead and found you on Instagram and followed you there, so I'll be interested to see more of what you're up to and follow you there. So it's good meeting you.
Yeah, I'll follow you back, and feel free to shoot me a message if you have any more questions or just want to talk movies in general. I could do it all day and all night.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
I guess what I'll say is I am the most intellectually satisfied of this episode of many that we have done, because you are, Gabriel, you're a very literate gentleman, and you know a lot about the film business. And it's been a pleasure, and we're going to get you back. So I want to say to everybody, thank you. We've enjoyed ScaryCast tonight. It's been so much fun. We've got an interesting guest next week. I'll be putting it up online. But, Gabriel, again, thank you. Dr. Trey Donaway, thank you. Steve Logan, Professor of Wrestling, thank you for being on board. And Devin Kane, thank you. It's been a pleasure, as this has been one of the more interesting shows that we've ever done. And, Gabriel, we're just so glad to have you. So I'll be doing the call around after the show to thank everybody. And we'll see you next week. The one.
Yeah.
The only.
The world's greatest
hour and a half ScaryCast. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Good night, John.